Welcome to Life's Issues with Lloyd Rosen, where the discussion will be about issues that affect people on a daily basis. Life's Issues is brought to you by the Tough Talk Radio Network. Now here's your host, Lloyd Rosen.
Welcome to another issue of Life's Issues with Lloyd Rosen. We are here today on another beautiful Thursday afternoon in the autumn to talk about different topics with our guests. We have two great ones today, and we'll get to our first one in a few minutes. If you would like to call into the show, you can dial 347-989-1363 and press the number 1. You'll be put in the queue for our producer to get you on the air. Normally that is true, but today the show has been pre-recorded, and if you would like to ask a question about the show you're listening to, you can email me at bowler900 at sb as in boy, c as in cat, global.net, and I'll be more than happy to get the answer to your questions to our from our guests and back to you in a timely manner. If you are a Facebook fan, you can go to Tough Talk Radio Network, or you can go to Lloyd S. Rosen. Either page will give you information about our radio shows and radio station. You can also be a guest on our show. I know you're sitting out there probably wondering, how do you get to be a guest? Well, you just go to Life's Issues with LloydRosen.com, and you click on the how to be a guest on the show, and you can fill out the registration form. Pick a date that you want to be on, and everything else is left up to us. You can go to www.toughtalkradionetwork.com to learn all about the other shows we have, and we have about 8 or 9 hosts, and we're growing all the time. All of our recordings are on iTunes. You can definitely download them, listen to them. If you have a question that comes up while you're listening to it, you're able to send me an email at bowler900. At sbcglobal.net, and it will get answered and sent back to you as soon as we get it. We don't like to leave you hanging because we know you're interested in getting the answers to the show. As I said last week on our show, I attended a Tough Talk Radio branch, which is called Tough Talk Business Network. Instead of Tough Talk Radio, it's Tough Talk Business Network. And it's a networking group that they have here in Pennsylvania that I attended, and you're more than welcome to check it out and join it and visit with us if you want. It is a branch of Tough Talk Business Network, which is out of Houston, Texas, so feel free to look that up and join in and get more information on it. For right now, we'll be right back after these messages with our guests. Welcome back to Life's Issues with Lloyd Rosen on this Thursday afternoon. My first guest is a young lady who has trained, who is a trained therapist. She's a trained yoga instructor and a health and wellness expert. She has a master's degree in therapy from Syracuse University, and she has the experience inspired her to help others because the best version of themselves and live their dreams by integrating therapy with everything that she's learned in Hawaii, where she lives 6 months out of the year now. She also has a master's degree in therapy that she got in 2013, and she does yoga certification and a number of other things. She has appeared on Dr. Oz's show. She has a lot of things going on. Like I said, she spends 6 months of her year of the year in Hawaii. She spends the other 6 months in upstate New York. At this time, I'd like to bring in my guest, Jenny Giblin. Jenny, how are you today?
Good, boy. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Now, I understand from talking to you off the air that you're just short of your 30th birthday, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I usually don't tell everyone my age, but I'm starting to become more comfortable with it. And I think I sound a lot younger than I am, so now I almost use it as like a selling point. Like, I promise I'm 30 years old.
So tell us a little bit about how a young lady like yourself gets interested in making a career from therapy and yoga. Now, because I'm assuming that your therapy is not normal, like psychology therapy. Am I correct?
Yeah, I think I started off really on that traditional route. I actually began my career as a school counselor. I had studied therapy and psychology while I was in college, and then kind of just went this traditional school counseling route. It really was not what I wanted. I really wanted to dive deeper. And so I ended up going to Syracuse University for their clinical therapy program as a master's degree trained clinician in marriage and family therapy. And while I was there, I think I really did approach therapy from more like a streamlined traditional clinical approach. And while I was in school, I had the opportunity, while I was halfway done, to move to Hawaii. And so it's much different than it was being from Syracuse and growing up in Buffalo. It's very snowy here. And so I kind of jumped at the chance to get out of the snow and leave winter behind. So I ended up in Hawaii, and I really kind of thought I was just taking a break from school. It was just going to be for a year, at least that was what I told my parents. But once I was there, one thing kind of led to another, and I started just discovering at a time that I really needed it too, The Power of Positive Thinking, which was actually written as a book in the 1950s, right outside of one of my favorite hotels in Oahu. And so when I discovered that book and all of these other books, like The Secret and The Power, I just started kind of reading them on the beach and started to see the role that they played in my own life and how it started to really just transform everything. And so around the same time, I became really kind of immersed in hot yoga. I'd been given a free membership at this amazing studio that had just opened. And looking back now, like, I just know all of those things, the way that they happened time-wise, it could not have been a coincidence. And so one thing kind of led to another, and I just remember being out there in Hawaii knowing I had returned to my program at some point and just wondering, how does everyone not know this? And so once I ultimately kind of made the decision to leave so that I could finish school, I started integrating everything that I learned in a way that I knew it could help the clients. And so it would go beyond that traditional scope of treatment so that we would start really addressing the issue itself, but in a more powerful way. And then to go beyond the issue once that was treated to really start designing the life of your dream. So it, in some ways, it's kind of traditional, but not really. And I think the results for that tend to be more effective than traditional therapy as well.
This is true. Traditional therapy doesn't necessarily be the end-all for therapy. There's different types of therapy. But also, I was going to say, going to Hawaii, January, February in Hawaii beats being in Buffalo, New York in January or February.
So. That is definitely true, and that was when we actually first went. It was January of 2011.
Yeah, well, it'd be the first time and only time I ever went, because I would have stayed like you decided to do. So the reason I say that with such tongue-in-cheek is because I personally, I'm living in New Jersey right now, but and I've dealt with the winter here, but I spent the last previous 10 years living in Texas. So in February and March, when it's still cold and blustery here, it was getting to be 80-90 degrees already down there, so I enjoyed that aspect of the weather.
Yeah.
But now, reading about you, I did find that you are a very big proponent of holistic approaches to treatment. Now, before I ask you to answer the question, I have done holistic medications, and the only negative thing that I find with it is the fact that because it's herbal and natural, it may take a little bit longer to affect your body in the positive way that it's supposed to, because it is herbal instead of the chemicals that the doctors give you. So tell us why you believe that holistic approaches is so effective, or in some ways it may be more effective.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I'm glad that you made that, because I think sometimes when I do tend to get excited about holistic treatments, I always kind of want to clarify, like, I'm never recommending that if you are on any type of medication or sticking to a scope of treatment that is seeming to work for you, I would never say that you should just quit taking medication and start taking a supplement. So I think sometimes it's good to clarify that. But for me, I just noticed for myself, I grew up struggling a lot with anxiety, and it was never really diagnosed. It was just kind of like a thing. No one ever gave it a name. I was just always very shy. I think that's what everyone just assumed, but it was really a little bit more than that. And so it tended to kind of go away on its own. But in high school, it just kind of, every time I thought it would go away, it would just manifest into something different because it never really had been treated. And so the anxiety that I was kind of just dealing with on a day-to-day basis manifested itself as an eating disorder. And I went to an all-girl high school where that was pretty actually normal. I think we all struggled with some kind of disorder, thinking about food and appearance and body image. And so it kind of went under the radar for a while. And then eventually I had to get help because it got out of control. And so ultimately, that is what actually led me to become a therapist, was the experience that I had. So I really do believe that in a lot of cases, therapy can be effective, medication can be effective, but when it still is not getting to the root of the actual problem and addressing the whole person from a wider perspective, I think that's where the problem tends to be. And I think a holistic approach is really focusing on wellness and really shifting the focus of treating a problem or just managing symptoms onto a whole other level of really making your life the way that you want it to feel on a day-to-day basis. And so I think for me personally, I used to take Xanax. I've been on, I don't even know how many different antidepressants. None of them were really effective at all. And I was actually resistant to going on them, but I think as a teenager, you're kind of just, you feel like you have to. And so that was what I did. And when I actually went to Hawaii for the first time, I was on the North Shore. We had just done this insane hike called the Stairway to Heaven. I couldn't even feel my legs. And I was just like loving every minute of it. And my cousin and I stopped on the North Shore, which is known for its huge waves in the winter. And I took out my purse just to kind of take out my phone, take some pictures. And a huge wave, of course, came and knocked me over. My whole purse fell into the water. And before, that would have completely like stressed me out. My phone was dead. All my pictures were gone. But I was in such a beautiful environment and doing all these things like hiking and kayaking and just like being on the beach and in the water that I didn't even care. And so that was when I first started noticing that kind of that shift happening. And the bottle of Xanax that I had to carry that I kind of would just rely on, I really didn't need while I was there, and it fell out into the ocean. And so that was kind of like this telling moment. When I came back to Syracuse to finish up that first year, I really just didn't need it anymore. And so I think now looking back, the more I think that I became just not reliant on it at all, like I feel like I was able to become that best version of myself that they train us to become in our clinical program, but on a whole different level. And so I really found that that holistic piece was like that missing part of the puzzle. And like that was what changed everything for me. And when I started using it with all of my clients, just seeing like the results that they would have, and even my supervisors at the time being blown away by the results that I was getting and just asking, like, what are you doing differently? And it wasn't me necessarily. It was just this other piece of the puzzle. And so I recommend a lot now instead of Xanax, which can make, it is effective, but it works right away, which is why I think it's so prescribed. But for me, like, if you look at pictures of me back then, I almost look like not all there. I don't even know how to describe it. And that's kind of how I felt, because it was just numb a lot of things. And that's one of the most reported side effects. People kind of say they feel like a zombie. And so now I really just recommend kind of more of like that approach of using exercise every day to really boost your endorphins, or shifting your diet, because so many things that we eat on a day-to-day basis that will literally, we're now finding out, are causing anxiety. So if you could make those changes, like eating more spinach, for example, or just foods that are proven to boost your mood and really incorporating those into your diet, you'll start to see a shift. Passion flower is a really good supplement for that, and it takes longer to have that effect. So I don't know sometimes if we're all ready to make that shift based on how severe the symptoms are, but once you can start to alleviate them, like these can be a really, really good way to boost your mood and to see a complete difference.
I'm sitting here, and so holistic medicine also, besides making you feel better mentally, it must make your body feel better physically, maybe less, because the chemicals in normal medications may give you issues like aches and pains and headaches and stuff like that. So holistic medicine is better along that way. What are some of the most important changes that you've made in your own life as a result of the holistic lifestyle?
I think probably the number one thing that I changed was not having to be on any medication at all. And I remember when I was in my younger 20s, like I would be at the doctor quite frequently, actually, and even as a child. And so now I really see that in a lot of ways, that the more anxious we are or just the more depressed we become, just the effect that that has on our body. And so if you think about it, that mind-body connection, our brain is basically that's our mind and that's in our body. And so it makes sense that when one thing is not really working well, when one thing is off, we're going to see other things start to become off too. And so I remember my file was always huge at the doctor's office. Like I really should have been healthy. I was 22, 23, 24, and I was on so many different types of medications. I had all these stomach problems. And so now I think I just went to the doctor for the first time in like 2 years, and I'm not on anything. And so it was just like this completely different file. It was like a different person, and that's honestly how I feel. And I think a lot of the changes that I made were just very simple ones that anyone can do. And so just really becoming more mindful of the ways that I was thinking and finding ways to change that pattern. And so for some people that can be through therapy. For me, it was probably that in the past. And then just now I use different affirmations to kind of block that negative thought from becoming a spiral out of control or from becoming a cycle. Another thing that I do, that the way that I eat has changed. And so before, I would eat bagels all the time. I'm from Buffalo. We love pizza and wings. So like that was like a weekly thing, and I would make that a daily thing, like if I could, to be honest. And so I wasn't really overweight at all, but I think if you look at pictures now, I even look different, although my weight is probably just like maybe 5 pounds less. But when I stopped eating gluten, and actually the only reason I did that was because of all the stomach problems I was having that had gone pretty much undiagnosed by all the specialists that I saw. And I eliminated that, just kind of my intuition told me to. And right away I started seeing improvements. The pain I was feeling went away. And I would say around the same time as when that anxiety started going away forever. And so I think when you start to focus on what you are eating and just making changes, just little ones, like it doesn't have to be like drastically cutting out all gluten, all dairy, like all meat or anything like that, but for what would work for you. And for me, it was making those changes and then just incorporating things like smoothies instead of cereal. I finally stopped drinking coffee for the most part. I stopped drinking Diet Pepsi. Like I just stopped having as much caffeine. When I was in grad school, I was having 6 cups a day, which is insane to me now. And now caffeine-induced anxiety is in the DSM. And I think so many people that I know of even go through, like, just drinking, like, whatever, not really thinking about it. So when you start to make those changes and you just start noticing what makes you feel good and then doing more of those, that can be a huge way to make a change. And then just making my workout routine instead of going to the gym and just, like, being on the machine, like, because I felt like I had to work out. Now I do hot yoga, which I know is not for everyone, but for me, that's pretty much the only workout that I do. And I try to go probably 4 times a week, but it really tones everything. It's so cleansing because you're in this hot room doing the poses, and so you really are sweating out toxins, and you just walk out of there, you just feel so amazing. And so I think for me, it was probably just a green smoothie routine that I have now, hot yoga, and then just kind of being willing, I guess, to like do the work and start using, I guess, everything I was prescribing for my clients, just making sure that I'm still doing that too.
Now, have you seen the same results from your clients as you saw? You make these recommendations, then your clients do these recommendations, and you've seen these changes in them as well?
Yeah, and I remember when I first came back from Hawaii, I was a little bit nervous, I think, not really sure anymore, because I felt like before, the way I did therapy was so different, and it was so, like, it didn't involve anything about like green smoothies or the power of positive thinking, but I knew all of that would work. And so I didn't know how I was going to combine those or if that would even be like allowed. And luckily the supervisors that I had were amazing. And they, I think both kind of had like a similar approach to some extent, and maybe not so much holistically based, but they were open to that and studying that as well. And so I was able to really find ways with each client on an individual, like one-on-one basis, to incorporate what I knew would help them in each session. And so sometimes it would feel like just a subtle shift, but those subtle shifts would add up and have a huge effect. And so I think on some level I knew that it would work for them, but then part of it too is like you start second-guessing yourself in your head, like, well, just because I did this, like, I don't know, like, is this going to work? And some of the cases I had were pretty severe. I worked in rape crisis and trauma, and I also worked at Upstate Cancer Hospital. And so I was dealing with families who were dealing with cancer and death and things like that. And so what was interesting, though, about this was that because I was able to tailor it for each person, it had the effect that it needed for each person. And so I even had a client who had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder for years. And so I would never have encouraged him to go off medication ever, and I didn't do that in the session, but we were able to find ways that he started incorporating in his own life that were just as effective. And now I just found out a few days ago that he's actually off the medication and doing amazing. And so things like meditation and breathing and just really making lifestyle changes, no matter what you're dealing with, is a lot of like that root behind the problem that we never really grasped as a society. And I think we're starting to get that now. And so I think when I was seeing the results, my supervisors were seeing the results, it just kind of started becoming just like more and more acceptable.
And it should become more and more acceptable, because I can tell you from my experience, I take a lot of medications for different things, from prostate and other things. And it's amazing to me every time I put them in my mouth and take them that I realize what I'm doing or what I could be doing to my body. So holistic medicine might be, especially if it has the results you say it has, could be an avenue for me to go down, which leads me to ask you about tips that you recommend for my listeners. And obviously, I'm asking the question, but I am becoming a listener when you give the answers. So they may want to become happier, healthier versions of themselves, which I'm going to include myself into.
That's a good question. I think sometimes, I think I mentioned just a few moments ago that those subtle shifts that we make and how big they end up becoming, I think that that can be really important in terms of how we approach a lifestyle change, because it's really hard to make like a complete overhaul, because you feel like you have to, kind of like on New Year's Day when everyone is like, okay, like I'm going to lose 50 pounds and I'm going to do all of this. And like, it's really hard to like look at that huge, big picture, and then it feels overwhelming. So we just kind of turn it off and then we don't do it. And then because we don't do it, we feel bad. So it's like this cycle, and it does not have to be that way anymore. And so I think one of the first things that I do is just recommend like a morning routine that you can do, whether it's the morning or the evening. But I find that the morning, you can easily do things in like 15 minutes. So no matter what your schedule is like, if you have kids, if you're married, if you're like running around in the morning, it can be stressful, but just it can be very easy. And so one of the things that I recommend doing for everyone is a very simple change. It's just drinking hot water with lemon first before you have anything else. And the reason for that is because it really helps alkalize our body. And so science is now finding like disease cannot really thrive in an alkaline state. It tends to thrive in an acidic state. And so even though we think lemons are kind of like sour and acidic, they actually digest in an alkaline way. And so when that's the first thing you're putting into your body, as opposed to something like a bagel or coffee or a donut and all of those things, this is really cleansing. And so that can be something that's very easy to make. Another thing I recommend is instead of having like a really heavy breakfast, just maybe trying to have a green smoothie, even just like a couple times a week, if you can do that. My dad used to be like a sugaraholic. He would drink like a pot of coffee a day and have Cheerios and like literally dump sugar on them. And he even drinks green smoothies now. And so I find that for me, it almost becomes an addiction. And I literally with clients will like write it on like a post-it note prescription, but it's so energizing, and you're literally getting all of that plant life into your body. And so you're getting all of the antioxidants, all of the energy is just kind of assimilating right in there. And so for me, it's actually more energizing than coffee to have one of those now. So you start to really feel amazing, and it's so easy. You don't have to cut down what you're eating. You can literally just make that one change. And I think what a lot of people start to find is then because they start craving those plants, and because a lot of the things in it, like spinach and kale, really are proven now to help boost your mood, you start craving more of what your body actually needs. And so it's kind of like the gateway into that. And so then you start making decisions based on what you really truly want and things that will make you feel good. But you're not even thinking of it in a way that feels depriving. Like, you're just thinking of it in a way that feels amazing. And then my other tip that I recommend for everyone is to just before you get out of bed, even you can start going through your mind, focusing on things that you're grateful for. And so the reason that I do this, it's one of the power of positive thinking tips that I read about in Hawaii that really, I think, changed everything for me. And I don't make my clients do anything, but this is actually something that everyone I do make them do this. But just a gratitude list or a gratitude practice. So what you actually think about tends to expand in your life. And if you believe that your thoughts create your reality, like, that's one thing that you don't even have to believe that. You'll just start to notice the effects that it has. And science is also now confirming that when we are focusing on what we're grateful for, it actually changes what's called the reticular activating system in our brain. And so that's the part of our brain that focuses on whether things are good or bad. And so because we're so busy, we just kind of tend to focus on good or bad. Like, we categorize it like a schema kind of, and automatically we tend to focus more on what's bad. And it's kind of like a survival thing, so that we notice it, so we think we're protecting ourselves from it. But as you can imagine, it just kind of takes on a life of its own, and we're almost like hardwired to focus on the negative. And I really do think that's why depression is growing in the country, why anxiety has been growing. And so when you start making a gratitude list, even of just 10 things that you're grateful for, or if you really just want to start with like 3 things, that could be a good start. But when you start to really focus on those things, you are literally changing what you focus on. And so you're hardwiring that reticular activating system back to focus more on the positive. So before I even get out of bed every day, I just go through my mind, like, just thinking of a few things that I'm grateful for, usually 10, or I just spend like a couple moments just thinking of those things after my alarm goes off. And so if you don't have time to like sit down and write a gratitude list, even though it is really powerful, you can even just do something like that. So you can do all of those things just when you get up in the morning, and you don't really have to make any big changes to your schedule.
And the most important thing is, you should never, as they say, if you go to bed with somebody, a husband, a wife, never go to bed mad. In the same instance, when you get up in the morning, you should always get up with a positive outlook before you get out of bed. Because work itself is, for some people, and I know a lot of people today, is negative enough. So you want to start the day at least with a positive outlook and be that way. Let me, Jenny, let me have you give our listeners your information as to where they can find you as far as a website is concerned, if they want to get in touch with you, find out more information from you.
Yeah, so my website is jennygiblin.com. It's just my name. And I actually have up on it now, it's a free cleanse that you can download. And so it goes through my routines for the morning, for the evening, and it has a couple of recipes that you can make very easily. And so that's all free, and it's all on my website, jennygiblin.com. You can also find me on Facebook or on Instagram, and I use the hashtag #therapies. It's just kind of the word I came up with to describe all of this, and it's now officially like a word. It's in the dictionary. So all of those links are up on my website.
Now, one last question I got for you, and that is, are there any resources that you would recommend short of them hiring you to help them, to help themselves?
Yeah, so I think probably the books that I refer to in Hawaii, I sometimes don't like recommending them because they sound so out there, but they're actually really not, and they're by Rhonda Byrne. She's most famous for writing the book The Secret. These books kind of go beyond that a little bit. So one is called The Power, and it's what Gandhi kind of referred to as the law of love. So it's really just about the power that you have to change your life. And then the other one is called The Magic, and that's the one that sounds kind of weird, but it's really just about the magic of gratitude, and it has 28 different gratitude exercises that you can do in those, and you can easily incorporate those into your life. And then one of my favorite recipe books is called The Beauty Detox, and it's by Kimberly Snyder, and it just talks about a lot of how the food that we eat really impacts us, and we're not even aware of it, and she really is able to break that down in a way that's scientific, but kind of more easy to understand, and her recipes are so good, so she's probably one of my favorites.
And I think that you touched on a very important thing in today's society, and that is that the food that we eat, because of the additives that they add into it, change a lot of what the product is supposed to actually do for you. And I think, unfortunately, I think a lot of the foods, because of what there is added into them, including our meats, hurt us more than they help us today. And that's why we do have to take a more holistic, more vegetarian approach to eating. I mean, even myself, who loves my meat, I think I can sit and eat vegetables a lot more frequently now because I know they're going to help me versus the meat. So.
Exactly. And I think like growing up in Buffalo, I was obsessed with things like chicken wings and like Buffalo chicken pizza, and I still want those things. So whenever I recommend it, I know being in yoga, a lot of people are vegan for ethical reasons, and I do kind of promote a lot of plant-based things, but I don't really consider myself to be vegetarian or vegan, but I do recommend it, and I do eat it a lot myself just because of how it makes me feel, and just you will start craving it. You don't have to eat things like frozen vegetables or things that you think are boring. You can find like fun ways to just start adding it more and more into your food, and you'll see the difference.
And I think we definitely have to take a look at what we're eating and how we're eating it and what we're putting into our bodies, because it's just so important. I know myself just from growing older. I'm 58, and I thought I would never leave the 20s. So I understand totally where it's important to keep an eye on what you're doing from a health perspective. So, Jenny, I would definitely like to say thank you immensely for an educational conversation about bettering yourself as a human being as we change our eating habits and our habits of meditation and stuff like that.
Oh, thank you for having me. I love talking about this stuff, so I'm very grateful to be on the show.
Well, like I said, thank you very much for coming on, and hopefully we will talk again soon. And have a great weekend and a great week, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you. You too. Bye.
All righty. Take care. That was Jenny Gilbin, and we will be right back after these messages.
Are you one of those people who deal with issues that life throws at you on a daily basis? Then you need to tune in to Life's Issues to hear Lloyd Rosen get the answers to those nagging problems. Begin to turn your life into that positive journey you've always wanted. You've always had the ability. Now get the information to complete the journey. Tune in every Thursday afternoon at 1:30 p.m. Central Time to hear Lloyd ask the questions that get the answers you are looking for. Lloyd wants to help those that are dealing with life's issues. Check out Lloyd's blog at LloydRosen.com for more information about daily problems.
Welcome back to Life's Issues with Lloyd Rosen on this Thursday afternoon. We are glad to have our next guest with us today. This is a gentleman that my hat has to go off to. He is a dad, a motivational speaker, an author of about 6 books that he's written. He is definitely out there, something that a lot of men don't take too seriously these days, unfortunately, but he has written a number of his books, if not all of them, on fatherhood and motherhood, and he is Hogan Hilling. Hogan, how are you today?
Oh, man, thanks for having me. I'm feeling dadly, and I really appreciate the opportunity you've given me to spread some dad love today and talk about my recent book, Dad's Behaving Dadly, and the new campaign that was started called Fatherhood is Alive and Well.
Well, I'm glad to have you on because, like I said in the introduction, there's too many guys out there today who do not take their fatherhood very seriously and who should, because that this is one of the main reasons that our family is deteriorating in the year 2014 and has dropped so far in what it should be. So, and my first question to you is pretty much that. The National Fatherhood Initiative says on its website that fatherhood is in a crisis in America. I have seen it deteriorate, but I don't necessarily think that it is in a crisis. What is you've got to say about that?
Oh, well, I totally agree with you. I mean, sure there are issues regarding fatherhood that we need to address, but I don't agree with the message that NFI and other organizations who support NFI's claim. And I'm not really clear what kind of message the NFI is attempting to share with the public about the current state of modern fatherhood. But one thing I'm certain of and feel for sure, it is disingenuous. While I believe it's true there are absent and irresponsible dads in America, which causes many difficulties for the children, the greater truth that Al and I have discovered is that most fathers are present, responsible, and very involved parents in today's modern world. And we truly believe that today's responsible modern dads far outnumber the dads who are not involved in their children's life. And I can back it up with some statistics, and I think we've been harping too much on what other dads have done in our past generation. The whole landscape has changed, and we'll talk a little bit more as the show goes on. But if you look across the country, I mean, they're expecting dads classes, which debuted in 1991, offered in all 50 states. There are dads clubs spreading across the country. I actually started the first dads club in Irvine, California, back in 1995. And now there's a Watchdogs dads club. I believe there's about 4,000 of those in 46 states. There's All-Pro Dad chapters, about 1,100 chapters in 45 states. There's a National At-Home Dad Network, which debuted in 1996. It has about 3,200 members, 52 dad playgroups, and it has the distinct honor of hosting 19 in a row conventions.
Wow, 19 in a row.
Correct.
Wow. Now, there's a definite, we all know that there's a definite difference between men and women. That's why we are who we are. That's why we have the emotional differences, the physical differences, total differences all the way around. Many argue that women are just more emotional and physically sensitive to their children than men are. Isn't it true then that moms are simply better equipped to be nurturing than dads?
Well, I totally disagree because I was an at-home dad for 20 years. Yes, 20 years, and my kids are still breathing and alive. You know, I think this whole attitude about men being inept is really also moms have started to realize it's a disservice to them, because if you really think about this, the women pick these men to be the husbands of the husband and also the father of their children, and they're allowing people to bash their role as fathers, which it's kind of an insult to them, I believe. But, you know, back to the issue of whether moms are better equipped to give birth to a baby and breastfeed, I totally agree with that. I mean, I don't want to deliver a baby, and I don't want to be breastfeeding. But I really, honestly, if you look at the nature of moms and dads and what our purposes are in terms of being parents, one of us has to deliver the baby, and God graciously gave that honor to mom. What we have to realize, though, that the only advantage a woman has is a 9-month head start, because there's no way that a dad can understand the physical bonding that goes on. But I've discovered men have nurturing skills and can be just as sensitive and caring as a woman. And nurturing is a skill a man can learn. A great example is the increasing at-home dad population. This population of men have proven that when given the opportunity, a dad is just as competent and capable as a mom of being the primary caregiver. And it's helped the feminist movement, who wanted to have equality in the workforce because their wives are earning much more money than they could be making. And the very fact that the children of at-home dads' families is proof enough that dads are just as capable as moms in the primary caregiver role, as I stated earlier, and just as moms are as capable as dads in the breadwinner role.
Now, I have a daughter right now who's 33 years old. When she was 8 years old, we were living in the New Jersey, New York metropolitan area. Her mother, my ex-wife, was from Seattle. She didn't want to live in New York anymore. So she said, I'm going back to Seattle. You drive back with your car. And Brianne wants to come with you, who's my daughter. And mm-hmm. so I spent 5-6 days on the road with my daughter in the car, having to be the sole responsible person for her, take care of her, watch her, make sure that she didn't hurt herself. And we created such a bond that I have to tell you that I have to fully agree with you on the fact that fathers do make great parents for their children. And unfortunately, I think that the negative press that dads get by being deadbeat dads and not paying their child support when they're separated and divorced gives the dads like you and me a bad name for ourselves. So
I agree, but it goes even deeper into that, because if you think about it, a lot of what this inept attitude towards dad is actually ingrained into our culture from the moment that we have kids, to the point where a little girl grows up to be a woman, she honestly believes that the man that she marries as a father is going to be inept. And men are the same way when they grow up, feel that, oh, I can't do this. Well, that's totally untrue. It's just that we've set people up for failure, and we need to start setting dads and women up for success. We're not doing that in the parenting world at all.
And I would have to say, in talking about that, that our society as a whole does that not just from a parental perspective, but from a man-woman perspective. The man mm-hmm. is always bashing the woman. The woman's always bashing the man. The woman always, you know, is saying, why can't you be a better dad? Why can't you be a better mom? You know, they're sitting around with their men friends making jokes about wives. I think that society as a whole has created a very bad tone about marriage and parenting, and I think that that's, like you said, that's where it all starts from, and it starts from a very early age.
Well, here's the kicker, is that I totally agree with you, and you know, you can say everything you want about our culture, and a lot of men have said, well, the parenting landscape is not father-friendly, and there's no dispute. Everybody agrees with me there that it's mom bias. But, you know, the bottom line is, if you want a father-friendly environment, act like a friendly father. And men aren't doing that, and women aren't embracing it. The point I'm trying to make is that men and women have caused this friction and problem in parenting. What I want them to focus on is that they're both the solution. We need to start working and embracing each other's differences. And that's why I did the Dadly book, because I want people to see a different perspective on dads. And as you read the book, you're going to find some heartwarming stories that totally dispel all the myths that you've had about the negativity and ineptness of men. And, you know, I hope that people will join this Fatherhood is Alive and Well campaign by purchasing the book. And moms, when you read this book, you're going to get so much out of it. And then encourage your husbands to read it as well, because they're going to get a lot out of it.
And they should. And they should. Now,
yeah, they can get to this. I'm sorry. They can get to more information about the book at www.dadsbehavingdadly.com. And I just want to make one important statement here, is that a lot of people have looked at this title and they said dad's behaving badly. It's a common Freudian slip, and it just proves to me how totally deep this message is of incompetence towards men as fathers. I have to tell how many people have looked at that title. I almost feel like, you can't read? It doesn't say badly. It says dadly with a D, as in David.
I can't believe you have to correct that many people. That's pretty sad that they're looking at it with a predetermined thought that it says badly instead of dadly.
Oh, yeah. I had one email from the PTA president, and she tried to correct me. She was upset at the title, and I said, it's not badly, it's dadly. And then she wrote back and apologized.
Do you think in today's society, I know that dads really, and I was a dad, so cleaning butts and vomit. I mean, I tell you a quick cute story. I say it's cute now, 33 years later. I came home from work one night. My wife was home. She was taking care of my daughter all day. She said, give me 5 minutes so I can cook dinner. She handed me my daughter. I said, oh, sure, no problem. I was bouncing her on my lap, and she gave out some gas, and I was laughing about it because I thought it was cute in a fatherly kind of way.
Yeah.
And I looked down at my black pants that I wore to work that day, and I literally had a mustard-colored line across my legs.
Mm-hmm.
And I handed her to my wife, and I said, here, hold her for a minute. And she said, well, I'm cooking dinner. You need to go clean her. I said, I'm not questioning having to clean her. I just got to get up and make sure this doesn't spill all over the couch and the floor and everything else. But having said that and having told that story, primarily dads want to teach their sons how to play baseball and how to play football and be there on the soccer field with them. And they want to teach their daughters the right way to become a woman and stay away from boys and teach them all the negativity about dating and stuff like that. But shouldn't dads, and here's another issue, instead of teaching their daughters all the negative and being negative about raising their kids, they should be teaching them the positive things about being a human being and raising them in that environment of being a good person.
I totally agree, but let me get back to this whole cleaning butts and vomit thing. It's another stigma again. I mean, I know moms who hate to change diapers and clean vomit, but like moms, dads do it anyway, as you had so eloquently shared in your story. Is that, you know, one reason that we have bought into this too is that a lot of times what happens when dads do try to engage in helping, and also, you know, diaper changing for men is bonding time. And I tell moms, I said, you do more to discourage than encourage his involvement. And they kind of shake their head and raise their eyebrows at me. And I go, you know, when your husband changes the diaper, okay, and then you start to criticize about it's too tight, too loose, or whatever, and then you clean the mess up after him, that's enabling, and that's giving him criticism. Nobody was around you, mom, through the course of the day, criticizing you for not putting the diaper on perfect. Your husband's going to make mistakes. Allow him to make mistakes, to let him bond with that diamond, build his confidence. Don't do it by criticizing. Most men say, you know, all I want is a thank you. But, Hogan, every time I change a diaper, it's either on back. They either point out that it's on backwards. Excuse me, does the baby really care if it's on backwards? Does the diaper still work even if it's on backwards? The answer is yes. But back to trying to support this example of dads not wanting to change diapers, look at the diaper table changing issue. When dads were out in a restaurant, they wanted to help change the diapers. But where was the changing table? It was in the women's room. We're not allowed to go in there. We had to fight and claw to get a changing table into the men's room. So what happened when we put it in the men's room? More men started changing diapers. That's just one of the problems that we had, and that's one of the solutions that we had. One guy stood up and said, put a changing table in the men's room so we can participate in the caring of our kids.
I can't agree with you more. I'm sitting here laughing about it because you're right. We can't go in the women's room. So what do they, you know, what do women expect? To change them right there on the table.
And you know what? Yeah, the other point I want to make is that, you know, a lot of what's going on here is not done intentionally. Our lives are so busy that from both perspectives, unknowingly and unintentionally, we're giving mixed messages to each other's genders. And then on top of that, we're not communicating. We really need to get back to square one and look at each other in the eye and say, honey, you're a mom. Honey, you're a dad. You do things different, but that doesn't mean we can't parent together. How can we make this work instead of putting up all these obstacles and pointing the finger at each other? You should be holding hands together and saying, we're going to parent together and embrace and respect each other's different ways. And that's what part of this Dadly book is about.
And it's a good message because I'm of the ideology that to take A and B and add it together and get to C, everybody is not going to take the same route to get to C. Although we'll all get there, we may take different ways of getting there. And the way a dad does something may not be the same way a mom does it, but it doesn't mean that it's wrong. And that's a very good point that you're making.
Well, here's an equation for you. Another equation. Motherhood plus fatherhood equals parenthood. But so does fatherhood plus motherhood. I think it's the commutative law of mathematics. It doesn't matter if you put the mom plus dad or dad plus mom. It all equals out to parenthood.
And we can sit here for a long time and discuss mother and fatherhood and parenthood and go in a lot of different directions, which I'm not going to do today. But I think you have a good idea of what directions we can definitely take this into. Now, the subtitle for your newest book is Dad's Behaving Dadly, and talks about 67 truths, tears, and triumphs. Now, there's a false myth out there that men don't cry. We all know they do. We all know that they should be given more power to be able to cry when they want to cry. But based on what your book says, 67 truths, tears, and triumphs, people are going to look at that and say, men don't cry. Why do you have tears in the title?
Oh, well, first of all, I have to thank all the dads who contributed stories to this book. They showed tremendous courage to publicly erase the awful stigma against men as dads, but more importantly, they showed a lot of trust and confidence in Al and I to produce this groundbreaking and compelling book about today's modern dads. And just a special thanks to Al for being my co-author. Yes, like you said, dads are capable of crying. Dads are human just like moms. Crying is a human emotion dads are capable of showing and expressing, as you'll read in this book. But dads have been conditioned not to cry. When dads do it, it appears abnormal. And many dads don't because they fear they may lose their masculinity. And that's one of the messages that I'm trying to send out to the dads, that you don't, just because you're nurturing or you're not on dad or because you cry, you don't lose your masculinity. Heck, I'm 6'6". I'll kick your ass if you tell me I'm a wimp. But, you know, and it also takes courage, great courage to go against the grain and then be behaving the way many people deem abnormal, unconventional when they see a dad being involved in public. You know, the first thing they do is they say, oh, it's a Mr. Mom. I got news for you. I'm not here to replace Mom. I'm a dad. Respect my role as a dad and just call me Dad. You know, at one time in our culture, we didn't think women could be tough enough to thrive in corporate America or politics. Well, the women certainly proved otherwise, and now men are doing the same in the parenting industry. And I can't think of a woman who made this quote, but to paraphrase, you're not going to get sexual equality in corporate America unless you give sexual equality in a home place. And I believe today's modern dads have proven they're capable of showing their sensitive and nurturing side without losing their masculinity. And, you know, the bottom line is we don't have a feminine side. We have a masculine side, and we can still show that sensitivity. For example, a dad who wrote about, there's a story where a dad wrote about depression and considered suicide. You know, you cried and you felt for this guy that because he struggled so much for his identity as a dad. We have a dad who wrote about the pain of miscarriage. I mean, how many guys have you heard talk about miscarriage? Very heartwarming story about how he was supporting his wife, but everybody ignored what he was feeling and how he was going through, and this is an opportunity for him to express his pain. There's a story about a dad who wrote about the pain of choosing to follow his wife or his son after both were experiencing life-threatening medical issues during the birth. The mom was in one hospital, and the son had to be taken to a different hospital. Imagine how difficult that was for him to choose which one he wanted had to go to. And I'm not going to tell you because you got to read and buy the book. And then we have a dad who wrote about his pain during his wife's miscarriage and how he comforted her. I mean, there's so many compelling stories in this book. The thing that really was impressive to me about this book is that the dads spoke about their shortcomings, about how they had to change their behavior and outlook on fatherhood. That is huge for me. And, you know, for the dads who read this book, it will give them permission to shed a tear or two. However, this book is not just not about the tears. Most of the book's content is about the truth, how guys really feel, and more importantly, about the triumphs. There's so many success stories in this book.
So having written Dad's Behaving Dadly, and it being your sixth book in your authorship, what plans do you have after this book is a success, as the other ones were, as far as a sequel or a series of books? Do you have another one in the works?
Oh yes. Actually, our publisher was so thrilled about the media attention and the sales that we are already collecting stories for Dadly 2. And we've got wonderful stories already coming in, and we invite all dads. The stories in the first book are from working dads, at-home dads, divorced dads, single dads, stepdads, dads of children with special needs, gay dads. We have stories from Australia, UK, Canada, Scotland, Canada. Go to the website, www.dadsbehavingdadly.com. Go to the submit page, and all the instructions and guidelines are right there. If you have any questions, just email us, and we'd be happy to answer. And submission deadlines is December 31st of this year. However, if you need an extension, if you email me directly, I will be happy to give it to you. And you can submit up to 3 stories. Some dads in the first book actually had 2 stories published in the book.
Ah, so multiple stories are encouraged if you have them.
Correct.
Okay. Tell my guests again, because you did it on your own earlier, but I'm now asking you to please give the information to our listeners as to where they can find information on you, your books, buying them, writing for them, whatever.
Yes, one way you can join our Fatherhood is Alive and Well campaign is by purchasing the book, and you can either purchase it at our website at www.dadsbehavingdadly.com. It's available on Amazon.com and also on at Barnes & Noble. And again, I'd like to invite all the dads that are listening out there, and for those of you who are listening, please invite other dads in your community to submit a story for the book, for Dad's Behaving Dadly too. We hope to have that out by Father's Day of next year.
And your Fatherhood is Alive and Well campaign is a campaign that can be joined by any person as long as they're a dad, or they don't even have to be a dad?
No, they don't have to be dad. It could be mom. Actually, we're getting more and more moms on board now. They're starting to understand the significance of this message. And they're actually emailing us and giving us comments. And we have a few reviews from moms on the Amazon.com at Amazon.com. If you look the book up and see reviews. And for those people who do read the book, please submit a review of the book. No, all people, all moms and dads can be involved in this Fatherhood is Alive and Well campaign. And they can just go to the Dads Behaving Dadly website and ask questions about that campaign and contact me, and I'll give them more information.
Sounds like a plan. I think it's time that, for lack of a better term and a lack of a better way of saying it, I think it's time that dads have been taken out of the closet, and their title of being a dad be yelled and screamed from the loudest and highest mountains in the United States and the world, because it takes two to tango. Everybody knows it. And when the child is born, it still takes two people to take care of them. And I'm not one of those people who believes that it takes a village to raise a child. As long as you have a mother and a father that are both involved in it, that those two can raise the child very well by themselves. So,
I just one quick message out to the dads is, you know, we need to start showing up and being active in our community and also supporting other dads as well. So, you know, do what you can in your own community. Reach out to other dads. We have not have been kind to our own gender. That's why I coined the phrase, if you want a father-friendly environment, you need to start acting like a friendly father, especially to our own gender. And by supporting each other, we can have one big voice instead of one small voice.
I, as a father and as a man, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's time that we took the bull by the horn and made something of ourselves instead of letting people just step all over us because we are good men and we should be recognized as that. So, Hogan,
well, what I say real quickly is show up, speak up, and stay up. And to all the wonderful dads out there who are doing a great job, keep on daddying.